Good evening. I'm Valerie Jackson. Welcome to this special edition of Between the Lines. We're coming to you from the Temple, the oldest synagogue in Atlanta. I'm delighted to be here again, and WABE thanks you for your giving us this opportunity to share the evening with you. As I look around the synagogue, I see some baby boomers who I'm sure remember vividly the turmoil of the 60s and 70s. Vietnam, Martin Luther King's assassination, the Black Panthers, the Black Power movement. One of the events that riveted the nation was the death of the young Chicago Black Panther leader, Fred Hampton. He was killed in his bed at 4 a.m. during a raid on his apartment. Many say he was just plain murdered in his sleep by Chicago police and federal agents. Joining me with a firsthand account of the event is one of your own, Jeffrey Haas, who was confirmed here in this very synagogue. Haas reconstructs step by step the events leading up to Fred's death in his recently released book, The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. A little bit about Jeff. Jeff graduated from the University of Michigan as an English major in 63 and earned his law degree from the University of Chicago Law School in 67. He worked for the Legal Assistance Foundation in Chicago from 67 to 69. In August of 69, Jeff and three other lawyers started the People's Law Office. The firm's first clients were the Black Panthers, Young Lloyds, SDS, that's Students for a Democratic Society, and demonstrators against the Vietnam War. Jeff worked as a criminal defense and civil rights lawyer for 35 years until 2004. During that time, he and his partners represented the Attica brothers, Lolita LeBron and the Puerto Rican nationalist, as well as ACT UP and protesters against U.S.-supported death squads in Central America. Jeff was one of the lead counsel in defending the 17 Pontiac prisoners charged with murder following the Pontiac Prison Rebellion in 1978, where three guards were killed. But after a six-month trial, all 17 prisoners were acquitted. In 1994, Jeff and his partners, together with other lawyers, represented the Ford Heights Four young black men framed for the murder of two whites. The four spent 18 years in prison, two of them on death row, before their convictions were reversed. The evidence showed that the sheriffs were sitting on documents that proved the Ford Heights Four were innocent, and four other people were killers. In 1997, the plaintiffs obtained a $38 million settlement with Jeff's help. Most recently, Jeff's family moved to Santa Fe, where Jeff is again representing victims of police abuse. Jeff is also a founder of Another Jewish Voice of Santa Fe, which offers alternatives to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which honors the rights of Palestinians as well as Israelis. Jeff, welcome back to Atlanta, and thanks so much for sharing this evening with us.
Thank you, Valerie, and it's very nice to be back here.
Well, no offense, Jeff, but I've got to ask you, how in the world did a Southern, upper-class Jewish boy come to defend the poor, often militant, and mostly the rebellious and the disenfranchised?
Well, I think that's one of the questions my book seeks to answer, because I go back and look at my history in Atlanta. My grandfather was one of the lawyers for Leo Frank, the Jewish businessman who was lynched in Atlanta by an angry anti-Semitic mob. Actually, it wasn't a mob. It was some of the leading families of Atlanta who were behind it. My father worked with the Voter Education Project and John Lewis. And actually, John Lewis wrote a beautiful eulogy for my dad, saying he was one of the unsung heroes of the civil rights movement. And because of his strategy, hundreds of thousands of blacks were registered to vote. My mom, who's here tonight and 96 years old, and I'm very happy to have her here.
That's Miss Betty, right?
That is correct. And mom came down from Cleveland, Ohio. She went to Wellesley, and she was going to become a lawyer. And she came into a very different environment in Atlanta in the 30s. Shortly after she arrived was the opening of Gone with the Wind. And I think for Mom, who came from a pretty liberal family in Cleveland, it was quite a shock to meet much of Southern Belle society. But Mom dug right in, and a few years later, she started the Atlanta Committee for International Visitors. And she entertained visitors from all over the world, of course, including the African countries. Atlanta was a showcase at that time for the South. But the hotels in Atlanta, they wouldn't allow the African visitors with their white chaperones to stay in the hotels. They would say, we'll take blacks or we'll take whites, but we won't allow them both in the same place. So one day I hear Mom on the phone saying, well, that's just unacceptable. We're not going to use your hotel unless you greet and welcome all of our guests. And it led to the Biltmore Hotel integrating, and very quickly the rest of the hotels in Atlanta integrating.
Wonderful. Great. Well, when you were young, though, I read in the book that you said that you and some of your friends, not real young, I think you were probably early 20s, but you called yourself Mother Country Radicals. Do you remember that? And what was that? What's a Mother Country Radical?
I think it's basically white people in this country who identified with the struggles of black people, Puerto Ricans, and the Vietnamese, and black people in South Africa, people seeking liberation. And I think we saw ourselves much more commonly connected with those fighting against the U.S. control, or as we said, U.S. imperialism.
Well, then you eventually, though, got your law degree, started practicing law, opened this law firm with your partners, and that's when you took on the defense of the survivors, the Panthers who survived the raid on Fred Hampton's apartment. Now, according to Chicago police, Fred Hampton was a very violent Black Panther who was intent on overthrowing the U.S. government. Tell us about the Fred Hampton that you knew.
All right. In writing this book, I've also learned more than even what I knew at the time. But Fred Hampton was a very open, warm kind of person. He was a very social person. I learned that he had, when he was 10 years old, he went and brought the neighborhood kids together and fed them breakfast on Saturday mornings because he knew some of them didn't get breakfast at home. And he started his own Breakfast for Children program when he was 10 years old. Fred had a big head when he was young, and therefore they used to
call
him...
You mean physically a big head?
A big head. Mm-hmm. And they used to make fun of him and call him Peanut Head. So he learned the retort to that and various things, and so he was known as the King of the Nines in the west side of Chicago.
Which is the dozens in many other communities.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And the other thing Fred did was he had a little bit of a lisp. And so in order to overcome that, he practiced speaking, and he memorized the speeches of Dr. King and Malcolm X. And he used to go to church and listen to the ministers for the cadence of what they said. So by the time he was 17 or 18, Fred was a magnificent speaker, and he could speak to welfare mothers, he could speak to law students, he could speak to gang kids. And I think that's one of the reasons why the government saw him as such a threat. He brought people together, he inspired people. And Fred's development was very sort of like somewhat a history of the black movement. He started organizing for black administrators and more black teachers in the schools. He went, one of the things, he led a walkout because black girls weren't considered for homecoming queens. There was no injustice that Fred basically could tolerate. And one of his issues was there was no recreation center or swimming pool for blacks in Maywood. So he led he organized people and went to the city council to demand a swimming pool and a recreation center. Whites could swim at a nearby Veterans Park, but it was segregated. So Fred was a leader of the movement. Because of that, he was made the head of the NAACP. He marched with Dr. King on the west side of Chicago. He also then joined the Black Power movement when SNCC and Stokely Carmichael and Rap Brown came to Chicago. And then he was one of the founders of the Panthers in Chicago in 1969. But through all of that, there was something very humanist about Fred Hampton. Somebody just wrote me, do you remember his bear hugs and his smile? There was something infectious about him. At the same time, he was very intense and very demanding of the people around him.
It was so sad that he was 21 years old at his death. Just think about what he could have done had he lived.
Well, 2 days before he died, I was in the Panther office. They were trying to buy their building because they had been attacked by the police 3 times. The building had been shot up, and they were afraid they were going to be evicted because the landlord's property values were going down every time the police put more holes in the walls. So I went over there, and I just have this glimpse of Fred Hampton coming forward as he's after we worked out the arrangements for the contract to buy the building or the deed, and just saying to people, you got to get to the breakfast program at 6 o'clock. You got to have the food there tomorrow morning. You got to get your petitions for community control of police signed. Just a steady flow of orders and back and forth. And it was like the Panthers worked off of his energy. But it wasn't just he was a commander. He was at the breakfast program at 6 in the morning. He did everything that he asked other people around him to do.
Tell us a little bit about the Panthers. What kind of routine did they have? Because, the only thing that most people know is that they carried guns, and they had their berets mm-hmm. and so forth. But what did they do on a day-to-day basis?
I asked somebody about what was a day like, and it was they'd get up at 5:30. They would go to the breakfast program. They would cook the breakfast. Somebody would have to clean up the breakfast. Then they might go out in the community and either get petitions signed for community control of police. Sometimes they would actually do questionnaires. What are the issues in the community? Is it police brutality? Is it housing? What are the issues facing us? Then they also started a health clinic, and they also sold the Panther paper. In the afternoon or evening, frequently they had political education classes in which they would go over various histories, ideologies, and so forth. So it was a pretty busy day.
Did women have a real role in the Black Panthers?
They did have a role in the Black Panthers, particularly and I knew more about Chicago than other places. But many of the leaders of different things like the breakfast program or the health clinic or the educational facility were women. And 2 women particularly told me that Fred really groomed them to be speakers. Mm-hmm. So there was certainly a macho style in the Black Panthers. They weren't averse to all of the other tendencies in the culture that we all experienced. But yes, there was a significant role for women, particularly in the Chicago chapter. And I just want to say one more thing. I was on a panel with some African-American history scholars, and the question came up, what about the role of women and what about sexism in the Panthers? Because we've all heard a lot about various things. And she said, yes, there was no question there was a top-down style. Sometimes there was a man who had some of the leadership roles. But she said, 2 of the things that the Panthers did were a breakfast program and a health clinic, things that traditionally women are most involved at. So that was a perspective that I hadn't had, and it was really interesting.
One of the things that frightened, I think, many people who did not know what and who the Panthers really were was their strong claim and champion of Black power. But just that thought, Black power, frightened a lot of people. What did Black power mean, though, to Fred Hampton and that phrase, power to the people?
Well, Fred Lee Hampton used to say Black power to Black people, brown power to brown people, yellow power to yellow people, red power to red people, and X power to anybody I've left out. It was sort of one of his... But he believed that. He believed in empowerment of all groups. And Black power to him was not an anti-white thought or idea. It was a way for Black people to get some control over their lives. And I think that's the way Fred Hampton saw it. He worked with white lawyers. He worked with white doctors. I certainly never felt any personal animosity toward that. But he did focus on the Black community because he felt that's who the base was, that's who the people in Chicago who in many ways were the most oppressed, and that's who he focused on organizing. But he also made coalitions with the Young Lords, a Puerto Rican group, and the Young Patriots, which was an Appalachian white group in Chicago.
If you've just joined us, I'm Valerie Jackson, and I'm coming to you from the Temple, Atlanta's oldest synagogue. I'm going between the lines with Jeffrey Haas, author of The Assassination of Fred Hampton. It's a riveting account of the death of Black Panther Fred Hampton at the hands of Chicago police. Based on witnesses and forensic evidence, describe what you think happened early on the morning of December the 4th.
Well, I interviewed the survivors and my partners gathered the physical evidence. And from that, what's pretty clearly happened, the police came in knowing it was a Panther apartment. They came in with a machine gun, a rifle, several shotguns, and handguns. So they came in prepared to shoot. Everyone says there was an initial knock. And following the knock, it seems like, there was shooting from the police side in. One idea is that the police just shot through the front door at whoever they hit. There's another possibility that the first shot was a somewhat accidental shot in the hallway by one of the police whose shotgun was up against another door. What followed was 97 more shots by the police. And we know that from the direction of the bullets. We know that from the firearms, from the shell casings that were found. There was one shot by Mark Clark, a Panther at the front door, that went up as he was falling, and we think it was from being hit already with a fatal bullet. We think they also then proceeded to the back bedroom where Fred Hampton was lying, and as his fiancée told me, after she was pulled out of the bedroom, I heard two police officers go in and say, "Is he dead yet?" I heard two shots, and then I heard, "He's good and dead now." And in fact, Fred Hampton was found with two parallel bullets going into the top of his head. Were not bullets that came from the front or the back or through the walls, but looked like a deliberate murder.
And you showed in the book how there was only one bullet from the Panther, a Panther gun.
Yeah, I showed that. The FBI firearms examiner found that. By the end, it wasn't disputed. Initially, the crime lab claimed they had evidence the Panthers fired two shotgun shells, but those shells actually matched up with police weapons.
One of the things that, when I initially read it, that bothered me was when his girlfriend said that when she was trying to wake him, that it was like he wouldn't wake up or couldn't wake up, which led to the thought of maybe what, that he was drugged?
Well, she told me that story 3 hours after the raid, and it was puzzling with all this gunfire. He's just sort of half waking up dazed, and I didn't understand why. And then when we had a second autopsy done, a former Cook County coroner found a large amount of secobarbital in his blood. Mm-hmm. Fred didn't use drugs, so we think that there's very likely that somebody drugged him that night. Not a fatal dose, but enough that he would pretty much be asleep during something like this, wouldn't wake up.
Mm-hmm. Well, you helped the survivors, the surviving Panthers, in terms of the trial, and you brought charges against the Chicago police. But there was a big objection by just about every public figure, including representatives from the FBI and so forth. But the crime scene, as you described it, was certainly one that was contaminated. I mean, I watch enough CSI to know that they didn't do right by that crime scene. So how is it that you even had to go to trial for something that appears to be so blatantly obvious?
Because Edward Hanrahan, the police were assigned to the prosecutor, which is an unusual thing.
The police were assigned to, you're right, were assigned to the prosecutor.
And normally the prosecutor prosecutes and the police carry out police function. In this case, the prosecutor who had declared a war on gangs, his name was Edward Hanrahan, and he was the protege of the then Mayor Daley, and he was the likely heir. And he sought to use his war on gangs as a political tool to get elected mayor. And he thought, I'm sure, when this raid happened, that he would get credit for eliminating or neutralizing the Panthers and even killing Fred Hampton. What he didn't count on was almost completely the black community rebelled and refused to accept the police version. While the black community was divided on the Panthers, they were not divided on a young man, 21 years old, being shot dead in his bed at 4:30 in the morning.
Let's talk about the role of the FBI. J. Edgar Hoover, he didn't particularly like the Panthers. He said the Panthers were, quote, the greatest threat to the internal security of the country. Whoa, that's pretty serious. I mean, this is notwithstanding the Ku Klux Klan and all the other kind of terrorist organizations.
Well, Dr.
Edgar Hoover.
J. Edgar Hoover had a program called COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program, which he started in 1967. And in fact, the entire left was a target, but the black movement was a particular target. I think some of us know he actually attempted to blackmail Dr. King with some tapes from hotel rooms saying, we're going to expose these tapes which show you having an affair if you basically don't kill yourself. So the Panthers weren't the only target. J. Edgar Hoover saw every black independent group as a threat. It was whether it was the Nation of Islam, SCLC, SNCC, all of these. But yes, the Panthers were his main target, and he directed every FBI office in every city with a Panther chapter to destroy, disrupt, neutralize, and cripple the Black Panther Party. Those were the orders. And specifically, he told them to prevent them from gaining credibility, prevent their coalition. And he had one particular line that really stood out for us: prevent the rise of a messiah who can unify and electrify the masses. And he wrote this before Dr. King was killed, so he said Dr. King might be such a person, Elijah Muhammad or Stokely Carmichael. And we think it was pursuant to this that the action was taken. Now, we have more than just a program that targeted the Panthers and a police raid. What we uncovered 3 years after the raid was that there was an informant named William O'Neill who was recruited into the Panthers. And William O'Neill, I knew him, he was very active in the Panthers. He was a provocateur. Mm-hmm. He built an electric chair to deter potential informants from joining the party, even though he was one. He built a mortar that was supposed to go from the Panther office to City Hall. And Fred said, you know, you got to disband that. That's crazy. But O'Neill, when we began to follow it up, we got another document, and it was a floor plan that O'Neill and his control agent put together a couple of weeks before the raid. And it showed the layout of the apartment, where the furniture was, the room where Fred Hampton and Deborah Johnson stayed, and the actual bed where Fred Hampton slept. And sure enough, when we looked at the bullets, the trajectory of the bullets, they came together around that bed. So Fred Hampton, the FBI gave that floor plan to Hanrahan and the Raiders, and they used that floor plan to execute the raid.
But the FBI had all these people blocking them, defending them, hiding them. And one other thing I wanted to mention, too, about the J. Edgar Hoover's order to disrupt these black nationalist organizations. There was one line in the book where someone asked, I guess, an FBI agent to define a black nationalist organization. And he said, any black group that has a national office.
Right. Right.
Is a black nationalist organization.
Right. It was a pretty broad definition. I mean, and frankly, that's very much the way Hoover was fearful of any blacks who organized.
That trial took 13 years, basically. And during the course of that, the federal government, or the government, some section of the government, was paying for the defense, if I'm not mistaken, for the defense of the Chicago police and the FBI agents who conducted the raid. Millions and millions of dollars. How did you finance your side of the deal? I know you didn't have millions of dollars coming
in. No, we didn't. And I think it was, we were young, we didn't have families, we were living collectively, so we didn't have a lot of expenses. My mom and dad actually helped pay some of my living expenses during the trial. So that was helpful. And so somehow we persevered. And when times got tough, we would say, well, what would Fred Hampton do? And Fred Hampton had a slogan that, you know, not to dare to struggle, dare to win. If you don't struggle, damn it, you don't deserve to win. And we used to, okay, and you know, we're representing a man who was killed, who was principled, who was uncompromising, and what would he do? And so we would just keep going. We had our other partners out making money. We had people raising money. Dick Gregory would hold benefits and, you know, things like that.
And you really, you had quite a bit of help, didn't you, from like law students and other private lawyers, organizations, NAACP?
We did. There was a black lawyer named Jim Montgomery who worked with us. Herb Breed from Howard came and worked with us during the whole trial. We got support from the Center for Constitutional Rights and the National Lawyers Guild. So even though we were the sort of point people in court every day, we did have support from a lot of legal organizations, and we had a lot of law students who volunteered.
In the end, though, eventually you were vindicated, and one of the people that helped you get there was Judge Swaggart. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Judge Luther Swaggart was, even though he came from somewhat of an aristocratic background, was a quite liberal judge who very much believed in civil rights. And we had presented a case of conspiracy. And we said there was a conspiracy between the FBI and the local police. And, of course, Hanrahan said, I didn't even know about this COINTEL program. How can I be in a conspiracy with people who have objectives I don't even know about? I never met some of these FBI people. And he wrote an opinion saying if people share an action together, they don't all have to know each other.
Swaggart wrote this.
Swaggart mm-hmm. wrote this, and it's a very famous civil rights opinion which establishes conspiracy and what you have to show to prove a conspiracy. And he held that we did prove one. He also reversed my contempt and said that lawyers have the right to be contentious and even obnoxious in pursuit of their clients' objectives. So we were vindicated that way, too.
Well, Swaggart's opinion in Hampton versus Hanrahan remains among the most famous civil rights decisions ever rendered. I want to thank you very much for being with us tonight, Jeff. Jeff Haas's book is The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. Thank you, Jeff, for allowing us to go between the lines with you today. And for more information, you can go to www.hamptonbook.com and hear and read more about the book. A special thanks to The Temple on Peachtree, Atlanta's oldest synagogue, and the host of tonight's event. And thank all of you for coming out tonight. And I want to remind you that there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. Good night. To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, go to our website at wabe.org/BTL and listen to an archived program. Or check out our suggested reading list for both children and adults. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to our website and click on Podcast. Be sure to join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor and technical producer, Mike Johns. Assistant producer, Colin Baylor. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue, and I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Between the Lines is a production of 90.1 WABE.